Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this edition of Business Nutrition. And I've got to say, this edition we are talking about and diving into one of my favourite topics for many reasons, but probably because when it comes to getting growth in a company, growing the sales team and developing a high-performance sales team is one of the most leveraged activities you can do. So in our interview for this edition, we are talking to Kristen Harcourt, and we're talking to her about recruiting and how do we find top salespeople, because anyone who has tried to find top performing salespeople will know that it's not the easiest job on the planet. Now, Kristen, let me tell you a little bit more about her. She is a senior consultant with a company called the McQuaig Institute. Now, the McQuaig Institute are a company that specialize in assessing and profiling high performance individuals. So they help companies in the recruiting side of things. And I reached out to Kristen for a couple of reasons. One, I've known her for a while and am aware of her track record. I know she is highly regarded in the industry and by her clients, but also because reaching out to a third party enables us to get a much broader view. I mean, Kristen's had experience across a range of industries and sectors, and so versus, you know, diving in and interviewing someone within a specific industry, we get a much broader perspective. So Kristen gives out just a ton of gems in this interview, and I think she does a really good job in being concise and, you know, getting to the heart of the matter. So I found a lot of her information very straightforward and easy to understand, and certainly resonated with a lot of things that I believe in practice when it comes to recruiting high-performance salespeople. So, look, I won't carry on anymore. I'll let you get into the interview. So without further ado, meet Kristen Harcourt. And on the line we have Kristen Harcourt from McQuaig Institute. Kristen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. It's been a while since we've connected, and it's great to chat to you again, and particularly excited to hear your take on hiring salespeople. I know with the work that I do in helping clients build their sales teams, hiring salespeople is certainly one of the toughest roles to hire for. So we're certainly looking forward to getting your insights and learning about your secrets and tips. So thanks again. If we can jump maybe straight into some questions here. So the first one I've got for you is, you know, when people think about hiring salespeople, they normally don't think too much about it being different from hiring any other role. And my belief is there is some differences, but I'm really keen to hear your point of view on this and see if you see some specific differences there. Would you say is a difference between hiring for sales versus hiring for other roles within a company?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when you look at something like sales, I like to say that sales is really a different kind of beast. When you look at other positions within the organization, sales is really, when you think about it, it's almost like an entrepreneur. There are some aspects associated with entrepreneurship that salesperson's really having within the organization. And when you think about what that person is doing day to day in the job, it's very different from a lot of the other positions within the organization. A lot of times these individuals might not even be working for a lot of the time in the office. They could be working remotely. They're the one that's really taking each day and deciding what they're going to be doing with their day. So they have to really be very self-motivated to decide, you know, what am I going to do to set up myself up for success every day to achieve the goals? And quite often when they're going to be in a position where there's going to be targets, what are they going to do to ensure that they're achieving those targets on a weekly, monthly, yearly basis? So there are individuals that are really working quite often by themselves. Definitely, I would say there's aspects that are different from an entrepreneur in that they still are being paid from an organization. They have that accountability to the organization. And depending on who that type of manager is, then they're, you know, perhaps are having weekly meetings. The other thing, if you think about something like sales, these individuals really have to be able to go out there and persevere on a daily basis and quite often deal really, really well with rejection. So these individuals can be, you know, having to go out there, persevere, and find this business. And it's a unique kind of individual that does really well in that type of role and in that type of environment as well.
Cool. Yeah. No, I would certainly agree with you. It's interesting to hear your thoughts. Now, when we are going through the hiring process, and granted, you guys are specialists in the assessment space, so I'm not going to probe you too hard on the whole hiring process unless you've got something you want to share with me there. But, you know, what do you see as being the tells or indicators that someone needs to be looking for or be aware of when they are assessing an individual for a role in sales?
So one of the things that I find really interesting when you look at something like sales, and I get this feedback a lot of times when I'm talking to clients who they say, you know, we had this individual and they were so good in the interview. We really connected well with them. They were really articulate. They were passionate. They were enthusiastic. When we look at, you know, in terms of their experience and their resume, everything on paper looked really good. And then we got them in the job, and within 2 to 3 months, it became very clear that they really were not going to be someone who was going to do well in sales. And quite often when I start talking through that and we look at, okay, why didn't that individual do well in the job? When we take a step back, quite often it's because they have some characteristics that would be associated with sales. So they're individuals who are very sociable. They can build relationships. They have high energy. They're enthusiastic. They engage with people very well. So all of those things are some aspect of sales. But unfortunately, the other characteristics that tend to be quite critical to being successful in sales are much more difficult to actually measure in an interview. And those are things, are those individuals going to be people who can deal with rejection? Are they individuals who are just naturally driven, who have that drive to succeed, have that drive to achieve results, who are naturally competitive? And that competitiveness can be around other individuals. But sometimes it's not even about that. It's just having that natural competition and competitiveness within themselves to achieve results. So those types of individuals work really well in target environments because they thrive to achieve those targets. They're so goal-oriented, and that really pushes them, that drives them. So if you think about getting no's, okay, they're like, okay, that no's just driving me to get the next yes. So it just pushes them. The other thing is when you look at another characteristic and trait that's really important for sales is that level of independence. So are those individuals, are they very self-motivated? Are they self-directed? Are they going to be able to day in, day out decide what are the most important tasks that I'm going to need to do to achieve these results to get more sales? How am I going to plan out my day? Where am I going to be the most productive? So they just have that natural ability to be independent, to be strategic, and then also sometimes thinking outside of the box. How am I going to solve these solutions for these companies, these individuals, to be able to get the sales? So those are characteristics that we find through all of our research and our experience, and then also just for myself, being at the McQuaig Institute for 7 years and working with a lot of clients, it's always consistently the same things. Those are the things that they really need for those individuals to be the top performers and to be very successful. And those, if you think about the things I just mentioned, Jamie, it's very hard to measure those in an interview just through having a conversation with an individual.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How many, your clients, when they're interviewing or recruiting salespeople, how many interviews are they normally doing? Do you have insight into that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it would definitely vary from client to client organization. So I have some that I actually get feedback that the sales managers are a little frustrated because it's too intensive. So it could be 5 interviews and they feel that they're actually losing out on candidates because it's too comprehensive an interview process. I say that the kind of rule of thumb, I tend to see 2 or 3 interviews. So a lot of times these days, first interview might be a phone interview, but still a phone interview that's going into a little bit of depth. So not, you know, something where they could be spending 45 minutes to an hour, but just asking some really critical questions to see, you know, in terms of do they seem to have the fit for what this job might be all about. Also verifying some of the things on the resume. Then bringing them in for an interview that's going to be face-to-face, getting to know that individual, definitely getting into some behavior-based interview questions. And then quite often, depending on what their process looks like, I might be bringing them in for a third interview. And that third interview could consist of a panel interview. It could consist of both the hiring manager and HR and perhaps somebody else in another area. So it could be the sales manager and the VP of sales. Depending on the size of the organization, for some of my clients, it might even be the CEO that's coming in for that third interview.
Gotcha. Okay, awesome. So, I mean, obviously, a lot of the characteristics you talked about there, and we'll get to talk about your assessment tool, but I'm sure they show up in there. And I guess even knowing the things you mentioned there, which I think you articulated really well, you might not be able to tell, you know, get a full scope on those things throughout an interview, but you can certainly be looking for those things in their behavior and in how they conduct themselves, even in communication back and forth between interviews, things like that. Would you agree with that?
I say some of the aspects. I think the independence and dominant aspects, those would be hard to be able to measure based on the communication back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
I do think what you could be also looking at, and one of the things we might get into, is that there's also things that can be used negatively. So if you look at someone who has really high dominance, they could have the ability to do really, really well in sales. But if you see any indication, a red flag would be, are they using the dominance negatively, which results in someone being extremely aggressive to get the results. And those can be individuals. And I've worked with some client organizations to say, as long as they're hitting their numbers, we're okay with that. But just to let you know, what that can result in is, for that manager, somebody who's very difficult to manage. And then in terms of working with the rest of the team members, someone who doesn't work very well with the other team members, right? Ostracizes them, or, you know, sometimes even contributes to being more of a toxic environment. So I would say, if you start to look at some of the characteristics you're looking for, it'd also be in terms of communications and things like that, that you see any indications as well of them using the behavior negatively.
That's a really, really good point. Yeah, one of the things that I really stress with my clients, and I'm on about all the time and very passionate about, is the culture of the organization. And I think that's what you're talking about there. If you get someone in who might be a rock star salesperson, but they're going to have a negative impact on culture, then, you know, that can be more detrimental than beneficial.
Absolutely.
So I want to talk about the assessment that you guys use. Let's talk about that now. Yeah, let's maybe share with us a bit about that assessment and why. I mean, I've used tons of assessments, and I'm a big fan of them. I do say to people, though, that they're a tool. They're not the be-all and end-all. They're one piece in the puzzle, albeit a very important piece of the puzzle that can help us get a faster and more in-depth understanding of someone in a shorter time frame. Would you agree with that? Like, or do you believe that your assessment, obviously you're the advocate for your assessment, but do you believe that it is one tool in the process, or is it more than that?
I 100% agree with you, and that's something that I always am very careful to educate clients about, is this is one piece of the puzzle. I would really weight it at around 30, 35% max. It's giving you some really good insights, some really good information that you can do something with. I'm a big proponent and encourager of taking the information and using those behavior-based interview questions and do some deep probing around that. I also think you want to use that information with references, right? So anything around the behaviors, that's a great opportunity for you to probe them, and based on information that's coming back, talk to those references. And one of the things around using the behavior-based interview questions as well, is you're getting people to talk about situations. Ask those questions in the right way, then you're getting scenarios that they're putting forward. Well, then you go back to those references and talk to that individual's previous employers and talk through that specific situation, and you're looking for any indicators of those behaviors coming through and asking questions around that. So I 100% agree with you, Jamie, and I think that you always want to be careful and make sure that everyone in the workplace that are using tools like this are educated that it's one piece of the puzzle and it's not a hire, do not hire tool on its own.
Yeah, cool. So with that in mind, now tell us a bit more about the McQuaig assessment tool. If there might be people listening to this who have never used assessments before, and there are probably some or quite a few who have. So maybe for the purpose of both those audiences, give us an overview and then tell us a bit about why your tool is different.
Yeah, so our tool has two pieces to it. So one is we have a tool that allows organizations to really define what they're looking for uniquely for an individual, for a role in their organization. So when we're looking at something like sales, well, I definitely think that dominance, drive, and independence is going to be required in all roles. One of the areas where I definitely see some difference would be the level of sociability and analytical. That can change quite drastically depending on whether it's a technical sales environment. And then also if you look at just the strength and how pronounced the different traits are, I think that can really change based on what that role is going to look like day in, day out. Is it a hunter type role? Is it more of a hybrid type position? So a lot of relationship building. And then even the environment they're selling in, the industry that they're working in, all of those things can have an impact. So I really like the fact that organizations can build a benchmark that's specific to their organization. Sometimes what they'll also even get into with building that benchmark is to assess their top performers, get a feel for what the profiles of their top performers are so that they can be hiring more individuals like that as well.
Can I just jump in there, Kristen?
Sure.
That sounds awesome. It also sounds complicated. I mean, is that difficult for a business owner to do, or is the, because I mean, I obviously haven't seen the tool, but is that relatively simple to do? Do you help them do that? How does that sort of come together?
Yeah, absolutely. So it is quite simplistic, but definitely the analysis is all being done from our end. Okay. So it's just essentially from their end having, you know, first of all, when we talk top performers, we need to make sure that we're looking at KPIs, right? So what are those key performance indicators, and making sure they're the same for all the people that are being put forward as top performers. And then they're just literally having those top performers complete the assessments. We're then extrapolating the data, and then we would do the analysis from our end and then let them know what it's saying and then build that benchmark.
Gotcha. Now, what if someone is, say they're a smaller company, they haven't got any top performers, or they're recruiting their first salesperson, how would they go about building a benchmark? Would you guys just give them something that you've used historically, or what would happen there?
So in that case, and I love that because we work with a lot of startup organizations, so that's where they would complete what we call the McQuigg job survey, and that takes about 15 to 20 minutes, and they're just ranking behaviors, and they're building that benchmark of what they're looking for in the salesperson. And again, we work with them, right? So we talk through, once the results come back, okay, this is what you've identified you're looking for. Does this sound right? And then like how's this going to fit into the overall plan, all of those other things, to just make sure that, yep, this seems great. So yeah, that's that first step, is really defining. And that's one of the things I think is also really important that sometimes gets lacked in terms of hiring and not getting the right person. Not enough time is spent up front to very clearly define what are you looking for in this role? Who is that ideal candidate? What does success look like? I think too often it's kind of rushed into starting to look for people, and that time hasn't been spent up front. And I think it's more important to spend a little bit more time up front to get that clear and then start to look at candidates, because you're much more likely to make a better hire.
Awesome. Now, I don't think we went into your tool too much. We talked about the sort of the job match side, job profile side. So why do people use your tool? What's different about your tool compared to a Myers-Briggs or a Profile XT or something like that?
Yeah, so in terms of the actual assessment, so one of the great things about our tool is the assessment that the candidate's completing is also just 15 to 20 minutes. So it's not too time intensive for the candidates. And that's one of the things we get in terms of feedback for some individuals, is that the organization just found that there's other tools in the marketplace that are an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours. It's just too much to ask the candidate to spend that much time. But the great thing is, even though they've only spent 15 to 20 minutes, the comprehensive report that you get back, and the amount of information and the great information that comes back that's very relevant and helpful is pretty amazing. I think that's another piece that's important to look at as well with our tool, is that it's really designed to be very easy to understand, very actionable, very user-friendly, very applicable to, okay, we're in a hiring situation, what's this telling me about this candidate? How can I use this information? So that somebody who doesn't, you don't have to feel like you have to be go into interpreter training and be a high-level interpreter. that report saying. I think that's a really important differentiator around our tool. And another really big piece with our tool, when you work with the McQuaig Institute, it's very important for us, the service piece. So it's not just a matter of clients start using our tool and, okay, here it is, hope it goes well. We really provide a lot of guidance, a lot of consulting. We work through an implementation plan with organizations. So we work with organizations of all sizes. So some organizations, they might have a very small 10 employees, 15 employees. They're only using a couple assessments. Some organization might be using thousands a year. It doesn't matter. We treat all clients the same way, and we really want to set them up for success. So we really work with them, figure out, you know, what are your goals? What are you trying to achieve with the assessment tool? How can we make sure that happens? And then we make sure that we also do check-ins. So we have what would be considered almost like a one-year onboarding process when a client comes on board. And especially if it's a bit of a large organization where several different stakeholders might be using the tool, and say, you know, how are things going? What's working? What's not working? What can we do to make sure that you do feel comfortable with the tool? What are you having problems with? And then give training, do webinars, do whatever we need to do to educate anybody who's feeling like they need to understand something better. So really providing that that service and making sure that our clients feel comfortable with the tools is really, really important to the McQuaig Institute.
Thanks for that, Kristen. Now, I've got a question for you just on the hiring process. At what point should people be using assessments? I mean, you know, you put the ad out there, you get your different lead generation sources, whatever you're doing that brings you in your applicants. Then there's some filtering process right through to then where you get down to the, you know, 3 to 5 in some cases interviews. Mm-hmm. At what stage do you say that people should be using the assessment tool, and with how many applicants?
So my recommended approach is to bring the tool in when you're at your shortlisted candidates. So depending on how thorough your process is and where you get to your shortlisted, that tends to be, from my experience working with clients, anywhere from 2 to 4 individuals tend to be those shortlisted candidates. Mm-hmm. The only time where I would recommend differently is we do have sometimes situations where people are using us, it's for a high volume role, and they really feel as they want to use our tool very early in the process as a screen out tool.
Right.
But in general, my recommended approach is to really bring us to that shortlisted. So for sure, there's been an initial interview with them, depending on that process, because for some of the people you work with, Jamie, it might only be a 2 interview process, maybe a phone screening and then a face-to-face. If that's the case, I'd say you use that phone screening and you know do as thorough as you can with that. Then you've narrowed down your top ones. Then I would say assess them before you bring in those top ones, if that's going to be the last interview. Because if you don't, you're missing out on some really good information that you could probe within the interview.
Yeah, cool. Now, just another question around the hiring process. And I'm always fascinated by different people's take on hiring processes. One of the elements I think is most important for an organization, because the people you get make up your organization and who it becomes and what it achieves. So I'm curious to hear your take on the key elements of a hiring process. And, you know, if you don't want to comment on this, feel free to skip it. But what do you see as being the key stages to help a recruiter or an employer pick the best from what's available? What do you see as being the key steps?
Yeah, so I think one of the things is I'd rather people spend a little bit more time in the hiring process than to rush through it, because it's worth it to invest that time up front to get the right person. Having said that, I think sometimes when we have these 3-month hiring processes, sometimes you do lose top performers, right? So I'd say you try to keep it in the middle ground for that. I'd say one of the things that's really important is to start off by being very clear about what you're looking for, so spend that time up front defining that. One of the things with the interview as well is that there's actually been some research that shows that, you know, 90% of decisions are based on the interview, but they're only 13% accurate. Mm. So, you know, all companies are using interviews, but are they using the interview to its maximum value? So, of course, I'm going to recommend something like an assessment is one thing to bring into the puzzle to be able to add a little bit more structure. And the assessment's not also, and this could be coming from something else. It doesn't even have to come from an assessment. But the other piece is also having those behavior-based interview questions. I think that's critical. I think too often the interview questions are situational questions.
Yeah, so expand on that for me, Kristen, because I think it's an important point.
Of course, of course. So too often questions are, tell me about your. Do you work well under pressure? Do you work well under pressure? Do you work well on a team? When you ask somebody questions like that, it's an opinionated question, then they're going to say exactly what you want to hear, right? But when you start asking those behavior-based interview questions, it's forcing them to have to come up with a situation, and you're really hearing them work through that situation and get at those behaviors. You're getting a much better idea with those behavior-based interview questions, which, you know, research really shows the best indicator of future performance is looking at past performance, right?
So an example,
I think too often.
An example of a behavior-based question. Can you give us one of those?
Sure. I actually was just looking at a report. So let me give you an example. So usually with an interview question that's behavior-based, it'll start with tell me about a time.
Right.
So I'll give you an example. Tell me about the hardest people decision that you have had to make in the last year.
Yeah, cool.
Tell me about a process that you have improved in your last job.
Awesome. Yeah, so it's getting to recall an actual event or a situation and explain how they dealt with it and what they did. And, you know, if I can add, and love to hear your take on this, you also get to see their emotion or their comfortability with them describing the situation. One that I've used is tell us a time when you were really stressed and what led up to that and how to deal with it. And you can see if they're really telling you a situation, because they might just sort of be telling about something and dramatizing it a bit. Other times they're telling you one that, you know, they feel a bit uncomfortable, embarrassed about. And so you can really start to get into some interesting truths, I guess, about the applicant.
Absolutely. And you bring up a really good point, because one of the things I also do when I'm getting into the behavior-based interview questions is say, oh, interesting. And when you're getting them to describe the scenario, and who are you reporting to at that time? And then make it clear when you're saying, and you're not going to do that for every single question, but say, you know, just so you know, I am going to be asking you for some references and going to be going back to some of these managers. So then it even more forces them to make sure that they're telling you real stories, because they know that you could be potentially verifying these when you start to talk to the references later on.
Totally. The threat of reference check.
Yeah.
So what will Sue say when I ask them about that situation?
Yeah.
Cool. That's great.
One of the other things I find that is I like with having something where you've got this structure around the assessment tool as well is there's been a lot of research to show the gut feel thing too, right? So a lot of times people start to form an impression. There's been tons of studies on this as well. As soon as they meet a candidate, within that first minute, they form some really strong impressions about that person, whether they like them or they don't like them. And then what they tend to be doing is throughout the interview, if they had liked them, just looking for things to further validate that they like them. And this is quite often on a subconscious level, right? And if they didn't like them, they're just continuously looking for things to validate that, right? So when you, again, take something else in and have some objective data come in there that's describing who that individual is, what they're going to bring to the job, all that kind of stuff, it's helping to take away some of that gut feel, or what they also describe sometimes as the halo effect.
Yeah. Awesome. Really glad you pointed that out. I think it's a really important point. Just back on, I guess, two questions. One, I want to ask you about where should employers be looking to find the top performers, but also back about culture. You know, what are the environments you find that those, I mean, you guys have seen the profile for top performers and know what they look like, and what are they looking for in an environment? Like, what's the type of company or working environment that they look for and are going to thrive in?
Well, it's interesting because I think one of the things when you look at top performers, and I mean, some of this is applicable to sales and it could also be in other positions, but one of the things for them too, when we're looking specifically at top performers, is there have been some really interesting research done by John Sullivan. It was actually looking at their values. So also taking that into consideration as well, right? So a lot of times there's certain things that they're looking for to achieve their top performers. There's certain types of values that they're looking to get, and that really relates back to the culture piece as well when they're working with that organization, right? So are they doing the best work of their life? Are they making an impact? Do they feel like they're in a job where they're getting to make an impact on customers, on the world? Do they work with a great manager? Is that manager pushing them to achieve bigger and better results? Are they getting opportunity to really innovate and take risks? Like, and the John Sullivan identified 14 different values, but I find it really interesting because a lot of times I think that gets left out of the equation as well. So when you look at these top performing salespeople, I don't think that there's necessarily one culture that's going to suit all of them, but it's getting a feel for that individual and what their particular values are and what they're going to be looking for in a sales role. And I think one of the things that happens sometimes in you want to be careful of is not to oversell the position, right? So sometimes you know it's a top performer, they're great, you want to tell them all this great stuff and this is what's going to look like, and yeah you'll have so much freedom and you can do this, and yeah, you don't really have to answer to us, like, as long as you're achieving your results and hitting your numbers, that's great. And then all of a sudden they get into the role and it's like someone's asking them on a daily basis what's going on and asking to be reported back, and they're not getting an opportunity to do some of this innovation stuff that they were told. So I think the culture thing, I don't think there's a universal culture that all top performing sales reps are looking for. I think it's something that you have a conversation with them and you get a feel for that when you're in the interview process. But I would caution that that sales manager that's hiring that person to be careful about, you know, because it's a two-way thing, right? Like, you're part of a brand, that top performer, you're selling them on why they should work for your company. Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure that you're really selling the company accurately.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And the way I sometimes explain it is that your hiring process should replicate your culture. People get a feel for what they're getting in for. And like you said, it's got to be realistic. If you sell something and they come in and get something else, then they might not hang around too long. Now, you mentioned John Sullivan there. What's the reference to his work there? I'm not familiar with the research you spoke of there.
He is something where he was identifying the values that A-level talent is looking for. I can send it over to you.
It's
quite interesting.
Yeah,
I'll send it over to you. But yeah, so he's looking at, because that's some of the things when you start to associate with culture and the whole thing around meaningful work, right? Mm-hmm. So when you look at sales, is like any other position in that way, and that if you look at a top performer, they still want to feel, a lot of them, sometimes it's just about the number, but a lot of times it's they want to achieve the results, but they also want to feel some meaning in the work they're doing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It has to be linked to a purpose. Okay, yeah. Cool. Last question for you. Where should people go to look for top performers? Is it a case of throwing an ad in the paper, or do they need to be out headhunting? What do you see out there in terms of where people are going to find these top performing salespeople?
So I love this question. I think it's really interesting, and I think it's about being quite creative, because when you look at top performers, 80% of them are passive candidates. So a lot of times they're already in a job, right? So it's how are you going to get at those people? And I think there's a lot of different ways that you can get to them. I think right now, you know, a job ads and those kind of things aren't going to go away. But I think another way that you can really engage with these people, and it's going to be new for some people, but is really leveraging social media. I think social media has huge potential, but it's not always used to its optimum value either. So when you look at social media, one of the ways to really get at those top-performing salespeople, it's not just about going on there and blasting out your job ads, you know, we're looking for a salesperson. It's about creating your brand out there so that they are going to see what you're all about, so that they understand, you know, what a day in life looks like to work in your organization, what's different about your culture, why they'd want to work there. We just did a global talent recruitment survey, and one of the things we found in that, when I was looking at people that were doing, were finding that recruiting was going well, that were more successful, a lot of them were working with employee referrals. So leveraging that, if you already have top performers and perhaps even top performing salespeople, have something in place around some sort of referral program. The other thing around social media is there's an opportunity to really leverage different things, such as if you go on to, like, I'm on a lot of different groups on LinkedIn, for example, and there's a lot of different sales groups. So go on to those sales groups and start engaging with those people. And it's not about going on there and posting jobs. It's going on there and sharing information of value, maybe sharing stuff about your company, but not necessarily about job postings. And then it's just going out there and having conversations with those individuals as well. So it's really kind of figuring out where your top performers might be hanging out, because again, most of them are, like, 80% of them are passive candidates. So they're not necessarily out there looking for jobs. So it's finding ways to really build those relationships with them so that they want to know more about your company and they get excited and interested in what you guys are doing.
So I think you've alluded to a really important theme there. And I think what you're saying is that don't wait until you need someone to start doing your recruiting work. Mm-hmm. Start building a presence, start getting in the conversation or the flow of where those people are hanging out. So when the time comes, you know, you've got some familiarity, people know who you are, and you've got some contacts to be able to leverage.
Exactly. I think that's critical. It's not waiting till when that job posting's there. You've already started to build that presence, that brand, that relationship. Absolutely. I think that's critical.
That's cool. That's a really great point. Well, Kristen, that is fantastic. Look, I think we've covered everything that I want to cover here, and I really appreciate your insights. I think you've shared a lot of good stuff here that people can take away and implement, consider in the way they look for and hire their salespeople. Now, I guess last question, where can people find out more about you and McQuaig Institute? Give you a chance to plug you guys here. Where do we go? What's the website they should go to?
Yeah, so for the McQuaig Institute, it's just www.mcquaig.com.
And McQuaig is McQuaig.
You got it.
Yep.
And I'm always very active on social media, so I'm very happy to connect with people on LinkedIn at Kristen Harcourt. Or as well, I'm pretty active on Twitter. As you can see, I like social media a lot. That's why I'm a big proponent. I think it's huge potential. So I'm also on Twitter, and same thing, it's just at Kristen Harcourt.
Okay, great. And I'll put those links in the interview notes there. Awesome.
Wonderful.
Great. Thanks very much, Kristen. I appreciate your time.
It's been so much fun. Thank you, Jamie.